which will be the last time this coming semester, which is a combined bachelor and master students course. But then there's going to be a new course that starts in a new study program that I will teach together with Bernard. And that's on the master level, right, Bernard? Yeah. So if you really like the topic I'm talking about today, you can have this in the back of your mind when you're choosing your subjects for the future. So I actually plan to deep dive a little bit today, not to scare you, but to hopefully spark some interest. So don't be afraid to ask questions, or if it's too abstract for you, think that this is probably better suited for a little bit more mature students. But I think that I'm not underestimating you. I think that you will handle this all right. So I have background in mathematics and crypto at NTNU in Trondheim. And also I did my PhD there in information security. I have a certificate that I'm a certified incident handler. I've been working 4 years at NSM NorCert, the national cert in Norway. 2 years I was the team leader for the operations center. So I was recruiting and also managing a team of incident responders, working around the clock, dealing with targeted attacks against Norway's critical infrastructure. Before that, I worked as an R&D engineer, and I did development and testing and standardization of communication protocols. And here are all my contact details. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm quite active on social media. And also you can add me on LinkedIn if you want to keep in touch. So that's about me. So the agenda today, I thought I would start at 14:15, but I'm starting now at 14. But we'll make time for a break in between, and maybe we finish a little bit earlier, since I started a little bit earlier. But I plan to talk about incident response, give you a kind of introduction to what incident response is, and then I'll dive into how to do the incident response when you're facing a really advanced attacker, someone that wants to infiltrate and steal your secrets, maybe a state-sponsored actor that is trying to get your national critical infrastructure's secrets by doing cyber intrusions. And I'll also give some examples. Some of them you might have heard about in media a couple of years ago. And some examples that of incident response that we actually did at NorCert. And at the end, I'll wrap up with a Kahoot quiz. I don't know if you have tried that before, okay? And I have, this is the prize for the winner of the Kahoot quiz, so you can have a chocolate if you win. I hope that's a good enough motivation to maybe keep you awake. We'll see. This is Swiss chocolate, and Bernhard brought it from Switzerland, so should be good. Any questions to the contents of the lecture, the agenda? No? So please feel free to ask questions as we go along. I don't want to have you all sitting here and wondering about what does this acronym mean or something like that. So what's incident response? So here's a definition of what an incident is. Because there's not everything that happens is an incident. If you work in a SOC, Security Operations Center, or a CERT, and you're getting intrusion detection alarms, there will be a lot of false positives. So we will get a lot of alarms. And also people contacting you if you're like at the help desk or an incident responder at the company. You will get notified about events that are not necessarily incidents. So the first step is to know what qualifies as an incident. Because you all the time you have unexpected things that occur, that may occur periodically. Like, for instance, users' passwords run out of time, so you have to change your password every 3 months, and then someone can't log into their computer. Of course, that's not an incident in the sense of an intrusion, but you might get some frustrated users that can't log into systems, and maybe they think that it has something to do with a DOS attack or whatever, and you can get false reports like that. But an incident, that's an adverse event that affects information resources or assets and is causing actual damage or some disruption. So it depends. It's not only that you have some disruption, because you can have disruption by planned downtime, for instance. But you need to needs to be an adverse event. And what's incident response? That are the measures, the procedures that you start doing when you detect an incident. So the first challenge is to actually know that you have an incident going on, and then you need to know what to do about it. So that's all that incident response is about. And it's not that simple, as I'll tell you today. But of course, this can be modeled, and there are a lot of models in this game. So be prepared to see some different types of models today. I'll start with the most easy one, I think. This is the one that NIST has made, the Incident Response Lifecycle. It's pretty general. So first stage is to prepare for incident handling. So you need to know, you need to have a team of people that know what to do, that have some tasks, that have some plans on what to do. You need to train them and so on. And then you need to actually detect that you have an incident. And when you get alerts in your detections, like your IDS, or when you get different types of alerts, you need to analyze these and figure out what to do. And then you're in the incident response phase. And that means you first should contain the incident, prevent that it's spreading more than it has already. And then the first challenge here is maybe to figure out how many of your systems are affected. Let's say it's a virus that has spread, or like a malware on your systems. Try to contain it. Try to figure out which systems are clean, which are infected. Where do you have rootkits installed, for instance, if there's an intruder that has been a long time into your systems. Might have installed backdoors, covered all the traces, deleted the logs, and so on, and made it difficult for the incident responder to figure out, actually, to have control of which parts of the system is not to be trusted, and which you can actually trust. And then when you have done the containment, you start the eradication, try to get rid of the intruder in your systems, and that means patching, maybe taking down computers, taking down networks, cleaning up if you have malware infections, and also, of course, safeguarding the systems again so that you don't get reinfected straight away. So, for instance, patching or otherwise reconfiguration of your firewalls and so on. And maybe also you need to put in extra measures for detection. And once you have eradicated, you're confident that your systems are okay and can be trusted again, you need to recover, because you might have lost some data, and you need to be sure that you set up everything back as it should be, or maybe even strengthen your defenses. And then you're over in the post-incident activity, which is a really important phase of the incident handling process, where you can improve your systems, improve the way you're, so evaluate how you handle the incident and learn from what you did in the incident handling, and try to be better prepared for the next time. Because there's no such thing as 100% secure systems, so you should be prepared for getting re-infected, getting a new intrusion. Any questions to this model? You seen it before? here's another model. So I'm just jumping from one model to another. This one is a little bit more granular, means that it's a little bit more specific, almost actually going on in the different stages. This one is from the Handbook for Computer Incident Response Teams, which is a great resource, but it's a little bit outdated. It's a while since this was published. I'll come back to more newer, modern types of models at the end of this lecture. But here you have sort of the same steps, but in a little bit more specified way. So here you have the first stage, where you detect an incident. So you get the different alerts or reports from different sources. And you have to somehow process these reports, these incoming reports of possible incidents, in a process called triage. Are you familiar with the word triage? Yeah, some nodding? A bit unsure? So this is borrowed from the healthcare world. So if you have patients coming into hospital at the emergency room, the doctors or nurses, or you will have a special trained nurse or some doctor in training or something that is doing the triage. It means assessing the patient and figuring out how critical this is. So if you're, for instance, in an accident, you might have multiple casualties or injuries, and it's important to figure out who needs help first and how severe it is. And this is the triage process. Often you put a color label on the patient, from red for really immediate treatment, orange if the patient can wait a little bit, yellow or... yeah, and so on. Green, maybe for the patients that can wait forever in the waiting room. Or at least it feels like that if you're at the Oslo Legevakt, as I have been. So you will get assessed and then you will put in the queue accordingly to your result from the triage. So this is also what you can do with the incoming incidents when you're working in a CERT or a SOC team, for instance. SOC, Security Operations Center, CERT, Computer Emergency Response Team, CSERT, Computer Incident Response. Yeah, also, there are lots of acronyms for the same thing. Well, sometimes the SOC is maybe a bit different than the CERT, because the SOC could also be... Oh, no, I'm... Yeah. You know the difference between the SOC and CERT? No? SOC is maybe the persons that are looking at the screens and doing like... they could be doing both network monitoring and security monitoring. So you have a NOC, which is a network operation center. People looking at if the network is okay, if everything is up and running and everything's working. Then you have SOC, which are the ones that are looking at security incoming possible alerts. And then I have a CERT team, which might not be the same persons as the ones that are looking at the screens, but might be like in a different room and doing a bit more strategic, figuring out what to do next and so on. Okay, so after the triage, you start the incident handling. And this can result in different outcomes. You might need figure out that you need more information to be able to handle this incident. You might have to coordinate with other people, other teams, other businesses, and so on. And that will lead to an information request. Or you might just deal with the incident yourself. Let's say someone's reported a problem with one of your products, if you're in a product search, and that might end up in a vulnerability report or a notice to your users about taking steps to patch and do things with their systems. Or if there's an incident that you resolve yourself, you might make an incident report with information of your findings while you did the incident handling. You do some analysis work. You will get something called Indicators of Compromise, IOC, that is some information that is really important to share with people that are battling against the same enemy as you are. So this will go into the incident report. And then coordinate information response, analyze more, obtain contact information because you need to interact with a lot of different entities. And then this goes around and around in circles until you have finally got your technical assistance, or you have provided your technical assistance to someone else, and then got more information, and then analyze new information. Maybe this spins out into more teams you need to contact. So this is a quite big process. And at the end, hopefully, resolution. The problem is that it's not always the case that you get to this resolution, or you kind of fool yourself into thinking that you're resolved, and you're out there, you know nothing, you think everything's okay, and then you're still in a state of being owned, and you don't know it. That's the problem. So it's not as easy as it looks like in this model. Questions? No? And it's really fun, I have to tell you that. It's so exciting when you get a phone call in the middle of the night. We are attacked. And you need to coordinate with all these people all around the world. And you feel like you're part of a defense for making the world a better place and fighting the criminals. And fighting the espionage people. So it's almost like in a James Bond movie. But it's all on computer. So no running around in car chasing and so on. But sometimes you get the same adrenaline feeling. So I haven't done CERT or incident response for 1.5 years. And I still feel like I'm missing out. And it's almost like withdrawal symptoms. I want to get back on the team because it's so exciting. Yeah. But the last 1.5 years, I've been doing research instead, and I've been doing some very exciting research too. So that's also fun. Okay, you need to have a plan to be able to do this. An incident response plan. And this incident response plan should contain a description of how you do these different processes. You can't just start doing this, you need to have a plan. You need to know what to do during the incident, but you also need to know what to do after the incident and before the next incident. So there's always something to do. The team is not sitting there idle and waiting for incidents. Probably you're just overwhelmed by all the incidents. Because when you start doing this right, after a while, you get better at it. And then you detect everything. And then it gets like crazy because you see everything that you didn't see before. It's almost like you took the wrong pill when you were offered the red or blue pill. And you were like in your nice world. And then suddenly, oh, this is what the world looks like. So, yeah. The plan should include what triggers the plan. So it should describe when you start doing these things. How you notify people about that there's an incident. For instance, how you get people to come to work in the middle of the night. You need to have a plan for that. And it's very nice if you can describe some measures of, for instance, that you can measure metrics. So response time could be one thing that you can measure your team against. So if you have things in your plan saying we will respond to every email within 1 hour. If you have a 24/7 team, this is possible. Or if you have, like, not a 24/7 team, you might get another response time. But then you can actually afterwards, when you have had an incident, you can see how well you did perform against these different indicators of efficiency of your team. So that's good to have some descriptions of that, and also to set the priorities for your team. These are some indicators that might trigger an incident response plan. You might get a phone call, email, might trigger. A lot of incidents are not detected by the victims themselves. It's detected by someone else. And then this someone else could be the FBI, the US CERT, some other CERT. They will send you an email and tell you, hey, we have seen all this suspicious activity aimed towards your network while we're investigating another incident. So this can set off an incident. Network administrator might see some strange things going on. For instance, in one case I remember quite well, it was detected by a network administrator that new users had been created by the domain administrator system. So he was looking through the DA and saw that, we have some strange users I never seen before. And this actually led to discovery of a bigger intrusion. Of course, intrusion detection devices, they are on the market, they are really costly, and there are a lot of vendors that want to push this thing on you, but sometimes they actually work, so they give you some not false positives. Happens occasionally. But it depends a lot on how you are tuning your systems yourself. So the configuration and the management of these things that is really important. You can't just buy a box from a vendor, put it in the network, and think, oh, we're secure, we have IDS. This box needs to be, someone needs to take care of this box. It needs to be monitored. Someone needs to look at the logs, the alerts, and you need to tune it into your needs. And so sometimes it just gives you a lot of garbage and the false positives, but sometimes it actually detects things. Also, systems like mail inspection, or you have deep inspection systems, can give you this alerts. And then it's looking for trouble. You need to look for trouble to find it. It means you actually have to look through your logs. You need to have, first you need to have logging in place, which is often a problem. And then you need to keep your logs for a while, because often when you detect something, it happened a long time ago, like months ago. And then if you don't have the logs available because you ran out of disk space and you rolled around your logging system, it's very hard to figure out what was actually going on at the time. Sometimes you detect that you're under a DDoS attack because things are not reachable anymore. That's usually quite a sure indicator of something is wrong. And also things can break. Very advanced attack against government systems was detected because some systems with Windows were blue screening. This was really advanced malware that was affecting the systems that was impossible to detect. It was not detected by any of this intrusion detection system. And it was not did not appear in any logs. But when devices started to malfunction, it was detected because Microsoft personnel had to come in to figure out what was going on. So this is really an advanced case. And of course, there's other things that might trigger the incident response plan. And this is just this first phase of the incident handling process. So how do you figure out if something is a real incident or not? Have you got any clues? You wanna try to suggest something? What types of questions should you ask if someone is calling you and saying, I think I have a real important or a really exciting incident going on here. What types of questions should you ask to figure out if it's a real incident or not? Or how big is it? No one has any idea. Okay, here's a list of questions. I really recommend this resource, David Bianco. Read his blog if you're interested to learn more about the incident response. He has some really nice articles there. And so I got this from his blog. He had this headline, what questions to ask to figure out if you've been compromised or how much compromised you are. The first is, was this an actual attack? Because it's not always the case that someone claims it's an attack. It's not always an attack. And then, was the attack successful? Because you also get reports about attempts of attacks. And that's also really interesting and important to follow up, because you can learn something from looking at failed attempts of attacks. But if it's successful, of course, you need to do a lot more. What other assets were also compromised? So this means that even though you get reports about one thing which is wrong, this might affect more parts of your system. So this is the containment thing. Try to figure out how big or how much compromised you are. And then, this is interesting to learn from the attacker. What activities did the attacker carry out? If you can look into logs of what was going on and how they actually gained access, this is really, really valuable information to be able to protect against this happening again. So this is really important. And then, how should my organization respond to this attack? And then hopefully you have this described in some incident response plan. Or else you have to have someone in charge that improvise and figures out what to do. So there are timelines for this. I'm not going to go into details of this figure. But you have different things that can go wrong. You have the incident response. You have disaster recovery. You have business continuity. And these are a bit different concepts. I don't know if you've been through this before. Have you? Have you seen this before? Okay, then I'll go quickly. But we are on this first incident response row, and now we are in the incident reaction phase. What to do? So what can we do? Of course, this varies depending on incident. But the first thing is, of course, to identify your affected systems. And you should do some analysis of logs and look at things, but you can't really deep dive into the analysis because that takes too much time. Forensics might take a long time. Of course, if you are really advanced team, you might have capabilities of doing forensics really quick. In that case, you should put it into your incident response plan. But usually, a very detailed analysis is not done straight away, because it you have to have really fast, actionable information. So the strategy is to focus on stopping the incident and recovering control of your affected systems. At this stage, you might end up getting a bit lost if you're really focused on who the attacker is. That's often the first question when you say we've been attacked. And then naturally, who is attacking us? And that can be really hard to say when you're in the start of an incident. In the start of the incident, you need to focus on what to do to avoid this becoming a bigger disaster. How to avoid this from escalating. And then afterwards, you can focus more on who is behind. But in some cases, you should focus on who is behind also from the start. And this is where we start moving into the advanced persistent threats or the big incidents where you need to escalate and you might need to involve law enforcement or you need to have a bigger team. You maybe need to bring in your hired consultants because you can't handle this on your own. Or you need to just escalate to a higher level of alert in the incident response plan. And then after the incident, it's really important that you follow up and you harden your systems, as I already said. And maybe the forensic analysis can be delayed until after the incident to get more technical details that you can learn from and that you can use to prepare for the next incident. And then, of course, after action review can help you also with figuring out what went wrong during our incident response, what could you do better next time. So after action review means sitting down with the team after you have done an incident handling and looking at all the documentation. Means it's really important to keep documentation while you're doing this, not just doing things. You need to have a person dedicated to do documentation, and historian responsible. So use this documentation in the after action review and look into what you did right or wrong during the incident response. And then you need to plan for before the incident. So before you start doing the real big incidents, you should have preferably a CSIRT or a CERT team, or maybe this is outsourced. If you're a smaller organization, you might hire in some services to do this for you. They need to be trained. You can send them to courses. You can do internal training. And the plans that have been developed need to be tested. In case you're not getting enough incidents that your people are actually sitting around and not doing anything, you need to engage them into training. Sometimes incident response teams are staffed by part-time employees that have this as a small, like 10-20% of their position and don't do it that often, then it's really important to train them. And these are some of the activities you could do to train the staff. So this is after the incident has been resolved, hopefully, and you have sort of ended your actions. I think I've been through this already, but it's one very important thing is that you should try to get into the root cause of incidents, even though this is really hard sometimes because you don't have enough logging in case, for instance. So you need to identify your vulnerabilities. What was the thing that led that made us vulnerable for this attack? And sometimes you can find these things by doing computer forensics. There is also a crucial point where people might get panicked and do the wrong thing because they want to plug out whatever, like pull the plug from the computer and shut down the system. And if you've already done this, you can't secure a memory dump. And some of this malware only lives in memory. So once you have shut down the system, all traces are gone. So that means in some cases, it's really important to secure the memory dump before you do anything, any active response actions. And afterwards, you should see if you can put in more safeguards to protect yourself for the future. And look into your monitoring capabilities. So you have all these fancy boxes in place in your network, but they didn't detect that you were actually under attack or that you had been attacked for a while and you had been compromised for a while ago. So should look into improving this. And there are different response strategies depending on the type of incident you're facing. So protect and forget. That's like the you just wipe your machines for or reinstall your machines to get rid of malware, and then you put them on again, and you sort of forget that something happened. You don't process the incident any more than that. You just try to clean it up and get back as soon as possible. And Problem is, as I already said, you might miss something when you do this. And you fail to learn from what's going on, because you didn't really look into how the attacker was attacking your systems. So watchful waiting means to keep a bit more calm, stay cool, don't do anything. You know you have been compromised, but the attacker doesn't know that you know. They might have been in your systems for a long time, and they thought that they were there lurking and they weren't detected. As soon as you detect them, you need to stay low as a defender of the system to watch and learn from the attacker and see if you can use that knowledge, the intelligence you learn, and to be better prepared for the future. And also to share this knowledge with others so that they can protect themselves against the same attacker. That's the watchful waiting strategy. And then you have the apprehend and prosecute. In many cases, it's impossible to get hold of the person or the organization that is behind the cyber attack. So there's not a lot of examples of someone actually being prosecuted for this. But in some cases, it's possible. For instance, if there's script kiddies doing this, they are not really that advanced. They don't know how to hide their traces. They do stupid things like bragging about this on Twitter or chatting in IRC with their friends and so on. That's really funny, by the way, when we had this anonymous DDoS attacks, I don't know, 5 years ago or something. They were trying to coordinate on an IRC channel. And of course, it was not only the anonymous script kiddies on that IRC channel. I think it was even more people trying to, you know, defend against this on those channels. So in that case, it can be easy to figure out who is behind. And then it's possible to gather enough evidence to actually hand it over to the law enforcement and get this person prosecuted. In that case, you need to have a little bit different strategy, because you need to worry about something called chain of custody. You heard this before? Chain of custody? So if something's going to be used as evidence in court, you need to treat it, this material, in a certain way to sort of prove that this has not been tampered with. And then you have these international crime gangs that are attacking your systems. And police do collaborate over borders, even though it's a really slow process. And there are some examples of criminals actually being prosecuted also in countries that we would normally not have a good police collaboration with. But you have to be really patient, like you wait years sometimes for this to happen. But in that case, too important to secure evidence and important to document how much resources and efforts you are using to handle the incident. Because if you go to court, you need to have a case for how much money, how much you should claim to, how much loss you should claim because of this incident. Okay, so when do we know enough about the intrusion to be ready to start getting rid of the attacker and their systems, and at the same time not hindering them from getting back into our systems? This is not a very easy thing. At which point should you sort of stop doing the watchful waiting, if that's your strategy, and start doing the eradication and cleaning up, or trying to regain control of your systems? So this is describes this type of advanced threat actors. And what I've seen a lot of times when I did this incident handling at NorCert. So if you look at the timeline, they started their attack long time ago. They started with a reconnaissance. So they started with figuring out how to attack your systems. And this they can do in a lot of ways. For instance, they can do like scans and hidden scans. They can just surf and look at your websites and get a lot of information about which people to send targeted spear phishing emails to, which suppliers, vendors are you having contracts with, and maybe they have don't have as strong security as you have. So if you have a, if you're an organization that has a lot of good measures in place to avoid people entering your systems, maybe you have a subcontractor that doesn't have the same security posture as you have. Maybe they have some holes in their systems. And then an intruder that is wanting to attack you might attack you via the subcontractor or your vendor or someone else you're having business relationships with. So the reconnaissance phase, the attacker is getting information about how to attack you and maybe also developing their tools and exploits targeted against you. And then there's an intrusion. And this is when the real incident happens. But then there's a dwell time. And this number, 468 days, I think it has decreased a little bit since then. But this is Mandiant, one of the larger firms doing incident response. They calculated the mean time it takes from one of their clients that where they did intrusion or where they did incident handling from they had been actually compromised until it was detected was 468 days. Kind of depressing number, I would say. So do you have the detection? And then you start incident handling. So do you see the problem here? Yeah? Problem is that you should have started the incident handling already over here to be able to sort of get ahead of the attacker. But we're fighting this and we have sort of lost already when we're starting the incident handling over here. So somehow we need to do this better. So we can't do this in a traditional way. We need to do it in a more sophisticated way. We need to answer to the sophistication of the attacker. And this is for the most, like, this is not the script kiddie thing. This is the digital espionage case, for instance. More targeted attacks. Because then you start cleaning up, and you might think you're clean up, and you might not be clean up. So, yeah. So, advanced threats. Yeah? Okay. Have a good trip.
Thank you.
And thanks for getting me here. Are you starting to get ready for a break, by the way? Starting to be a little bit tired? Yeah. You mean anomaly detection, for instance?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you now you're talking about methods that are used in the dependability area, in order to predict how fast components will tire, for instance, so that you need to replace them before the break, and so on. These are based on statistical models and predictions of the like the quality and the lifetime of different components. Yeah, so there's a lot of data that you can collect, and that you can. So I'm not going to go into CMs in this talk, but it's like it's possible to use that kind of same approach for computer security as well, to get a lot of data from a lot of sensors and then look for clues of infections. And some of these boxes that I mentioned, they do something a bit like that. But I would argue that you need to have a human in the loop in this case, because you need to you can't trust like fully automated systems on detecting these things. You need to have trained and skilled analysts too that can use this type of prediction systems as an indicator. Yeah, so applying big data and different like visualization techniques and so on onto big data is a hot topic. So yeah, that's a really hot topic in the information sec or cyber security world, is how to use big data analytics and also like visualizations of big data combined with human analysts to be better at detecting and predicting that you're compromised. So yeah, that's it's possible to do that type of work too. But sometimes the hard part is getting hold of the data. Yeah. To know what type of data that's actually valuable to feed into those types of systems. And you can get the data overload problem. It's been discussed a while, and there are also products out there that do these types of things. But it's still research material. Yeah. Because we're not perfect in detecting these types of threats today. So do you want to have a small break now? And we start again in 15 minutes? I don't want you to fall asleep, so let's carry on after the break. Okay, let's start again. So, have you heard this acronym APT before? Advanced Persistent Threat? Yeah, that's the kind of incident handling I've been talking about in the last few slides, about the intrusions that go undetected for a long period of time, because we are fighting against a little bit more sophisticated type of attacker. So this is usually someone that has a job, which their job is to attack others, like attacking other nations. So they're employed, and they go to work in the office in the morning, and they use their daytime job to try to get into others. Other companies or other nations' computer systems. And they often have multi-year intrusion campaigns, which means that they can have, like, at the start of the year, they have a list of these are prioritized targets that we will try to get into this year or next year or the year after that. So they have a long-term perspective. And often this is targeted against economic, proprietary, or national security information. So they're trying to steal secrets, they're trying to get into our critical infrastructure, or to get hold of things that can be used for supporting industry. And often they try again and again. So if they don't succeed the first time, they might try more different types of ways of getting into your company, your systems. Often spear phishing campaigns, which means that they send out large amounts of emails that are targeted, or could also be smaller amounts of emails that maybe go more undetected. And if they don't succeed, they will tweak their approach a little bit and try again. So they don't give up. It's not like they have this list of targets and say, oh, we tried once, we didn't get in. Now we move on to the next one. They keep on trying. And that's why it's called persistent. And they learn. So they learn from their failed attempts. And they adjust their methods. So that's why, in order to protect against these types of attackers, we need to do the same thing. We need to also learn from their failed attempts and use that information in order to tweak our defenses against it. And conventional incident response methods, they fail to mitigate most of these intrusions. And that's because we have some flawed assumptions. So the first thing I already illustrated for you is that we assume that you should start a response after you've been compromised. As you saw on the previous figure, that's way too late. You need to start earlier. And also, we assume that the compromise was a result of a fixable flaw. Means that there's a hole in our defense wall. If you just patch that hole, they won't get in. But that's not the real solution to this, because they will just find another way of getting in. So we need to be awake, we need to be alert, we need to learn also from their failed attempts. We need to try to stop them before they get to the point where they actually intruded into our systems. So here's another model. This is a model from Mandiant called the Cyber Attack Lifecycle, which describes this a little bit from the attacker's side. You see this? Is this some lights that we should turn off? Which one is the light switch over there? I have no idea what this is. Aha! It's too dark, you will fall asleep. Is this better? Okay. So, you can see what's on the slide now. Okay, so this is typically how the attackers think.
when they are attacking our systems, the advanced persistent threats. So what they do first is the initial reconnaissance, figuring out how our systems are exposed to the internet, for example. Could be one way of doing that, figuring out who they should send the spear phishing emails to, and so on. And then they try again and again, and then they will have an initial compromise at one stage or another. When they have got this someone to click on the spear phishing email, for instance, they are in this employee's computer, but they need to establish a foothold into the organization. So they will try to escalate the privileges, and they will start scanning internally in your network, which is the lateral movement. So they do some internal recon, and then they move within your systems, and then try to hide themselves, try to maintain persistence, try to get to that domain admin server or another valuable server on your network that is up and running all the time. So not someone's laptops that is switched on and off, and it doesn't really give you a good enough foothold. So they put in their backdoors, and they hide the traces and so on. And they keep doing this. They keep trying to move around in your network and maintain their persistence. And then when they've got the information they were after, they will complete their mission by withdrawing from your network, cleaning up after themselves, try to not leave any trace of their mission, and they're off with your trade secrets. So that's a typical way that these attackers think. So how should we defend against this? We need to do this based on intelligence. We need to learn from the attackers. We need to share this information among the defenders in order to be able to beat them. Because the attackers, they share information. They are not isolated in their own, like, there's not this, this is not a one-man operation from a basement somewhere, like Donald Trump seemed to believe when he was talking about this. he was talking about the 400-pound hacker in mom's basement. But this is not the types that I'm most worried about when you want to protect national infrastructure. You're worried about these office types. And they share information. And they have like A team and B team. So first they might put in the B team or the C team to see if you are weak. Or to see if your defenses are weak and you're easy targets. They give you their interns or their not that skilled attackers. And let them have a go at trying to get into you. If they don't succeed, they might escalate you, put you up on a more prioritized list and give you to the A team. And then you are in trouble. So, yeah, you need to analyze how they are working in order to defend against them. That means finding indicators that can be used to discover new activity. And not look at these intrusions as singular events. We need to try to connect them together, try to figure out how they're linked. And look at it as a phase progression rather than a single event. Because there's a plan behind it, right? It's not random. And then you need to put this into your intelligence feedback loop. So you need to gather as much information as you can get about the attackers. Because this actually gives us the upper hand. It gives us information superiority. And this can be helpful when we defend against them. And this, as we learn from them, we will get better at protecting against them, and they will have a harder time. So next time, then we need to put in the A team straight away, right? Or maybe there we will get so skilled that their A team can't figure a way to get into our systems. And what are indicators? What are the things that we should be looking for when you do this intelligence gathering? These are different types of indicators you should look for. Atomic indicators means indicators that cannot be broken down into smaller parts. These are kind of the more simple indicators, like IP addresses. IP addresses that are scanning our networks, for instance. IP addresses that we use to send out malicious emails. Or more importantly, because these two first things are not really that interesting, they don't use their own infrastructure to do this. They will hop via several steps and use infected systems around the world to do this. But more importantly, the IP addresses of the command and control servers that are collecting information or doing things, sending instructions to the malware that is lurking in our networks. That could be more interesting. And if you can get one step further from that, that's really interesting. Email addresses, domains that are used, and so on. These are atomic indicators. And then you have computed indicators. This is data that you derive from the atomic indicators or from other data involved in an incident. Typically, hash values. So if you have a malicious file that is found on your systems, this malicious file might be delivered in different ways, but it might be the same file within for several victims of the same threat actor. So you take a hash of this file and you share this information so that others can look for the same thing in their networks. And also you can have like IDS rules, which rule to put into your intrusion detection system to detect this type of spear phishing email attachment, for example. Or IP addresses used for traffic that goes back and forth to the command and control server. Do you know what the command and control server is? Yeah. That's a typical thing you will put into your IDS routes. And then you have the more descriptive behavioral indicators. And these are a collection of ways the intruder acts when they come into your system, or ways they act in order to come into your systems. So like, for instance, this is one. The intruder initially used a backdoor, which generated network traffic matching some kind of regular expression, and the rate at some frequency to some IP address, and then replaced it with one matching the MD5 hash value once access was established. So this is describing how this threat actor behaved when they entered your system. You look a bit skeptical. Is this clear or is it it's understandable? Okay, great. And you also have a kind of indicator life cycle. So once you get a report, so this could be something you get from another search team or from one of your threat intelligence feeds, which is also a product that you can buy or you can subscribe to for free for some of them. You will get lists of IP addresses, lists of hash values of files, and so on. This will go into your system, means that the indicator is revealed, you have it. Then you can use this, leverage it, and this will sort of mature in your systems. You will deploy it, you will start looking for it, and then at some time, this indicator will allow you to discover something. And then that indicator has been utilized. And once you discover something, this might lead to further indicators. So maybe you just had some of these components, like atomic indicators, but then when you discovered it in your own network, you can say something about the techniques and procedures of the attacker. And this leads to a sort of better indicator that will go into your system again, and that you also can report outwards to the whoever you are sharing information with. Okay, questions? No? I think it was good we had a break before this. I promise you, I'm going to come to some war stories after a while now. That will be even more interesting. But as I already mentioned, we want to share indicators of compromise, or IOCs. Because that's how we as defenders can collaborate to fight this. There are some frameworks that exist for doing this. And this is something that is sort of very hot topic at the moment. A lot of work goes into this, trying to figure out how we can share more information. So information sharing is a really important part of incident response. So how should the indicators look like when you share them? You can, of course, just write an email and say, hey, everyone that we're sharing information with, we discovered this threat actor in our networks, and they use this IP address for the command and control server. We saw some traffic looking like this. Then we found some file with this hash, and so on. But if you put it in that kind of unstructured email, and once you get kind of a lot of people sharing information like that, it gets a bit confusing and a bit troublesome to work with this information. So it's better to have it in a kind of standard format that you can automatically put into your systems and your tools and process it, like you were sort of asking about before the break. TaxiStix is a framework for this. This has also been developed further, so you can look up more information on this. If you Google a little bit, you'll find more information about the standards for information sharing based on TaxiStix. OpenISE is another format that has been used by Mandiant. And then you have MISP, which is an example of a malware information sharing platform, or a sharing platform for indicators of compromise. And also a place where you can put malware samples into systems so that you can share these too. And this is being used by a lot of different certs. So this is a work in progress and still being sort of starting to be used by cert teams. And this shows the framework for Styx. Maybe a little bit too much information on one slide, but it's trying to describe the. So this is basically an XML format scheme for sharing data. So it describes how data should be formatted and so on, but this is how it's grouped. So you have something called an observable, which is the data that you're looking for. You have an indicator, which is the specific intelligence that I was just describing, like IP addresses and so on. And then you might have a more behavioral type of indicators, which can also be called a TTP, tactics, and procedures, describing how the attacker is working. So how are you doing it? What were you doing? And then you can also add information. So all of these fields are voluntary. You don't have to add all of them. But you could, if you want to, add what they were trying to target or trying to exploit. Some might consider this a very sensitive information. So maybe not everyone feels comfortable sharing that. Then you can leave it blank, of course. And then you have something called a campaign. Campaign means that you saw something that was a part of something bigger. So you've seen this before, but maybe in another variant. You've seen some of the same infrastructure use, for example, and you can sort of collect this together and make it plausible that it's the same threat actor behind it. This is a little bit troublesome too, because the problem is that this is not an accurate science. It's so easy to make mistakes when you try to group this together, because you don't know who's behind, but you have some indication of who's behind. And then you might make the wrong assumption, and you might also have someone trying to fooling you to look like something else, like planting false evidence so that it looks like this came from someone else. And then you have firms in the threat intelligence business, like, for instance, CrowdStrike, that name the campaigns after who is behind. Which can be a problem if you then discover at a later stage that, oh, we did a mistake. So it's not that. So we have this campaign that we call something Panda. And it turns out, oh, it was not the Chinese behind it. Because they have this naming strategy where they name campaigns they think is coming from China, something Panda. If they think it's coming from Russia, they call it something Bear. So if they do a mistake in their grouping, it sort of becomes a bit troublesome to roll back again. And it's confusing because different firms group this differently and give them different names. So you're talking about the same thing, but it has different names. So for instance, you might remember from 2014, there was a spearfishing campaign against energy sector in Norway and also all over Europe and all over, like, many nations got this. And CrowdStrike named it Energetic Bear. So they blamed the Russians by calling it Energetic Bear. And Kaspersky called it Crouching Yeti. So it's the same thing but different name. And some referred to it, F-Secure referred to it as Havex, which is the name of the malware being used in some of the spearfishing runs in the same campaign. So you have like three different names for essentially the same thing, and it's all confusing. So yeah, so this part is a bit confusing. And then who is doing it? Threat actor. And sometimes these are linked, as I told you. Yeah. And then, maybe more important, course of action. What should you do about it? That's what we need to know as defenders, what to do about this. So you can also put that into this information sharing scheme. And this is how MISP looks like. So you have a dashboard you log into, and here you can insert information about your IOCs that you want to share, so you don't have to send emails to everyone. So everyone that's subscribed to this, that you allow to share things with, will see your indicators in this platform. Okay. Intrusion kill chain model. Another model. This is developed originally by some analysts that were fighting APTs and were getting really good at it, because they were getting a lot of targeted attacks against them. This is from the Lockheed Martin, you know, Lockheed Martin team, CERT team. So they developed this model after having been hit by a lot of spear phishing campaigns. Yeah, they developed F-35. So they had some very valuable information that someone wants to invest a lot of resources into getting hold of. So that's why they get targeted, of course. So they have this model which says that you have 7 steps in an attack. And the beauty of this model is that they actually put in courses of action on each of these steps, so that you can, depending on where you are on the scale, you have some things that you can do to defend yourself at this stage. And if you are successful in doing that, you can actually stop the intruder before they get to the exploit phase, which is the hack. So you have left of hack, right of hack, and you are probably, if you're not really mature in working with this and doing this type of incident response, you're probably in this right of hack state. You discover that you're hacked, and then you start doing the courses of action. But ideally, if you follow this model, you will shift to the left and you will be able to do some things to stop the intruder before they get to the exploit phase. That's the point of this model. And these are the different steps. So again, describing from an attacker point of view what they do typically during an APT-style intrusion. Of course, this isn't working for all types of attacks, but it's very describes, for instance, spear phishing campaign really well. So you have the reconnaissance, weaponization, where they make the weapon. So based on the information they gather, they will tailor make some exploit for you. For instance, they figure out that everyone in your company are running a outdated Internet Explorer browser, and then they will look into their arsenal and see, do we have exploit for Internet Explorer version so and so, and maybe they have it already, or maybe they go out in the zero-day market and buy it, or they have some in-house development team that can develop an exploit for you, and then they deliver this somehow. For instance, by spear phishing email or other types of ways. And then you're exploited, you're hacked, it's installed in your systems, they escalate, or they start moving around your system and get a foothold and so on. They might typically have a command and control phase where the implant is in your network and it's phoning home and asking for instructions. And then they do their action. But they want to get from your network, to find your secrets. And this is also described in this paper that I'll refer you to. And so this is where they have courses of action, what to do to try to protect yourself in all the seven stages. I'm not going to go into deep detail in this right now. We don't have the time for that. Any questions? It's very military inspired. So this is that's also why I call it the cyber intrusion kill, the kill chain. It's a kind of defense military jargon. So it's very inspired by that. True. But it was a new way of thinking about doing incident response against these targeted attacks. Because you don't wait until you're hacked until you start doing the courses of action. That's the main message here, if you don't get all the details. If you're really interested, I really, really would recommend this paper. Just you can find it on the internet if you Google for it. Intrusion reconstruction is also something you can do inspired by this model. As I said, you want to shift left in your defender side. So you want to move your detection analysis up the kill chain and implement the courses of actions as soon as possible. And this you can do by actually analyzing every single intrusion attempt, not only the successful ones. So catch all the attempts and try to learn from the attempts and see if you can recognize some of the techniques, procedures that the attackers do. So if you can catch these emails before anyone clicks on them, for example, that's a good way of stopping it early. But that means you need to analyze the campaigns. You need to look at multiple intrusion kill chains over time and see where you have overlapping indicators and sort of group them into different threat actors or campaigns. So linking together perhaps years of activity, which means you need to have all this log information to be able to do that. And you need to have a team of people that are focused on the threat intelligence, not only running around patching computers. So you need to have people dedicated do this task. So the goal is to determine the intruder's tactics, techniques, and procedures. also called modus operandi, or also called attribution. Or attribution could be like a side effect of this. It's not the main goal. So that's where some people do some kind of mistake. They think this is about attribution, figuring out who is behind. But it's actually, it's not about attribution. It's about trying to protect ourselves from getting hacked again. So it's not actually trying to find someone behind and prosecuting them. Because in a lot of cases, it's fruitless when you're facing this type of cyber attacks. So this is not easy. This is painful. It's really tough. And most organizations, they never reach the top of this pyramid. And this is also from the same blog as I recommended earlier, that I recommend to read if you want to learn more about incident response with Bianco. It's tough, really tough, to get to this level, to know how the attacker operates. This is easy. So getting a hash value of a file that you found malware on your computer, easy work. Like catching traffic in your network monitoring systems of IP addresses that are doing bad things on your network, like scanning and so on, also easy. Domain names of like where bad things are coming from and so on, it's also easy. But then you get to like more challenging and annoying things, like figuring out what is on the host, what is on your network, how does it look like. What kind of tools are the attacker using? Most likely they're using tailor-made tools, but sometimes they also use like common hacker tools, and they try to look like script kiddies. So that's also a way of hiding in plain sight. And this is the really, really tough part. And most organizations, they are like in this area. They don't get to this because it's so hard, and it costs a lot of money and resources. Of course, there's a cost. You need to do a cost-benefit analysis. How important are your assets? How much will you invest in computer defense, network defense? I also want to refer to a friend of mine, Frode Humedal. He used to work together with me at Norcert. Now he is a team leader at Telenor Cert. And they are also fighting this type of attackers, as you've maybe seen in the media. He developed this terminology called the Cyber Threat Intelligent Matrix. And that's actually a way of trying to figure out when you're at the stage where you can feel confident that you know enough about the attacker to start eradicating. So when do you know that you have enough information to be sure that you're not missing very crucial things that you need to know before you start trying to get rid of the intrusion? So, he has done a lot of presentation about this, so you can find this slide on SlideShare. And he developed this methodology called FatPi. So, look at your knowledge quality. How much do you know about the attacker? Do you know their footprint? How they usually look like when they come into your network? Do you know their arsenal, like their tools? And do you know their tradecraft, how they're doing things? That like you can get from simple to more advanced, like you saw in the pyramid of pain. And then how much do you know about which attack stage you are in? So think about the kill chain model or the other cyber intrusion development model. Is the attacker in the preparation stage, in the intrusion stage, or are they already executing and doing what they want to do? Like starting to exfiltrate your information. And here you can sort of get this in a matrix that will give you some color of how certain you should be, where you should be before you start acting and doing things to protect yourself. And it's sort of also measuring the maturity of your responses. So Lockheed Martin, they developed this kill chain. And I don't know if you remember the secure ID attack. RSA, were victims of cyber attack. RSA produced a two-factor dongle that Lockheed Martin used in their to log into their systems. So it seems like the persons doing the incident response at Lockheed Martin, they were so advanced that the intruders decided to instead attack their supplier of the two-factor authentication mechanism. So they managed to get into RSA systems. They managed to get information about how the seed or how the random number on the two-factor dongle was calculated. And probably they then used this information to try to intrude into Lockheed Martin. So they were able to stop this. Director of Cybersecurity Steve Adjaye said, "We almost missed it. We thought at first it was a new person in the department, but then it became really interesting." So they actually were able to detect this because they used this this strategy. So the Chinese has been blamed to be behind many of these APT style attacks. And this is an example of how the defenders can unite in order to try to fight this type of intrusions. So Operation SNM, there was an operation that was announced in 2014. And there were a lot of big players in the security industry that was behind this. Symantec, Cisco, FireEye, they launched this together with Microsoft and others to fight a specific threat actor that was behind a lot of these spear phishing campaigns, also known as Deep Panda or Shell Crew, the Axiom Group. So as I said, these are different names, but they mean the same thing. They have been noted or blamed by the U.S. to stand behind a lot of state-sponsored spear phishing attacks against academic institutions, also government agencies, and space and aerospace industry. So this was launched to as Operation SMM to fight this specific campaign. So that's an example of how we can defend. And one of the more famous APT campaigns was the one that was sort of the first campaign that was released information about publicly in a big report from Mandiant, which is called APT-1. How many of you heard about APT-1? A couple of you? Was also named Comment Crew, and Mandiant claimed in this paper that there was a specific section in China from the PLA that was behind this specific campaigns. And the U.S. intelligence agencies had been following this campaign since the early 2000s, since at least 2002. And they had in their classified material called the Byzantine Candor. They had been following this threat for a long time and sharing information secretly or in closed channels. And then Mandiant released this report and all this information was suddenly public. So a lot of this sharing of indicators and so on had been going on in the intelligence communities, but it had not been public information before this. And they were called the Comment Crew because they used HTML comments to hide their communication, so to hide their command and control server traffic. This is from the kind of press release from this. They share this report with around 3,000 indicators. So they had collected and followed this group for a long time and over several intrusions and intrusion campaigns. And they found a lot of indicators. So they decided to release this information so that defenders could use this to protect themselves against this threat. And this is a figure from the report. You see something interesting in this figure? Global APT1 activity. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, for us, we are on the map. They have recorded one intrusion or intrusion attempt tied to this in Norway. But actually, they are not describing all the activity that this group has done, because my boss at the time were talking to media also about this, and he said that NorCERT had been following this threat actor for several years, and we had seen more than 20 campaigns targeting Norwegian industries and Norwegian interests from the same threat actor. So this is one of the things that we were battling against when I was working at NorCERT. So I want to tell one war story here, or a couple of war stories maybe, from my time at NorCERT. I started working for NorCERT in 2011, and this was one of the first big incident I was involved in doing incident handling on. It was very interesting because there was a report released in August of 2011. Dell SecureWorks published the HTRAN report. Anyone of you know what HTRAN is? No? So HTRAN is a HUC packet transmit tool. This was a hacker tool authored by Lion, a well-known Chinese hacker. Dell SecureWorks were researching one of the malware families involved in the RSA breach when they came upon an interesting pattern in the network traffic. When the sample under analysis attempted to connect to the command and control server, the server returned a plain text error message. Looking like this. Instead of the expected HTTP formatted response. And this error message pointed to the quite old Chinese hacker tool HTRAN. So they were investigating the RSA breach and they came up on this, connection to FEN. And if you Google or if you search for this information, you'll see that this is then connected to this specific hacker tool. Because when the HTRAN code was written, it was written so that the connection bouncer is unable to connect. If it's unable to connect its hidden destination, in order to relay incoming traffic, the formatted error message containing the target host and the port parameters will be sent to the connecting client. And this is as long as there is no connection issues. And as you know, internet is not always up and running, things go wrong, you don't always have a connection. So what happens if you don't have a connection? Because, well, usually the HTRAN was used to hide a Trojan's command and control server's true location by bouncing off different servers. But in case there's connection downtime between HTRAN and the hidden command and control server, this sort of bug allows you to detect the real destination. So if the proxy is not working, it will sort of bypass the proxy, which is not a good thing, because then you're not hiding anymore. So Dell SecureWorks, they implemented a scanning system which checks for this HTRAN error message in response from active probing or lots of IP addresses that they knew were connected to this Trojan. So this was over a long time, and this resulted in this map. And as you see on this map, there are some blue spots and some red. Can you try to guess what's blue and what's red? No? So the blue ones are the proxy servers that we use to hide the attacker. But the red ones are the ones that they discovered because of this problem with the implementation of the tool. So you can see that... Well, you can see something that's maybe a little bit interesting here too. You spot this? This one is in Norway. So this blue one there. So of course, when we saw this as NorthCert, we were like immediately, wow, this is very interesting. Because we had been working with a case during the summer before this report was released. Turned out to be connected to the same thing, where we had discovered this. So we as National Cert was contacted by a security researcher, and we were given given information about the compromised server in Norway. And as part of doing incident handling of this server, we had already analyzed some network traffic that was going from the server. So let's take a look at that. So this is the analyzed server in Norway. And from the network traffic, we could see the attacker logging in to the Norwegian compromised server via RDP, remote desktop, and opening an SSL session to the victims, and it looked like this. So whenever or before the threat actor logged on, there was a lot of traffic incoming from compromised computers, and it was just stopped, so connection failed. But as soon as this threat actor logged on by remote desktop, the SSL traffic went through. So we could actually observe this in the logs. And this is a timeline when we're looking at this. We see all the resets, and then we see the remote desktop coming in, like pretty regular. So if you put this in UTC -8 office hours, they logged on, and they were logging into this office in these office hours, and they had like a break in the weekend. They didn't log on in the weekend, then they logged on again, came back to the office, and then you can see the traffic going through. So, yeah. The upper red segments are the RDP traffic from our attacker, the middle blue is the SSL traffic coming from the compromised victims, and the lower green lines are all the resets where victims are trying to connect to the commands and control server, but the attacker is not logged in. So, one thing I should mention in this is that we were not working to figure out who was logging in to this servers. Our main concern at the CERT was to notify the victim. So we actually used this log information. We had the list of IP addresses from all the victims that were trying to log in to the command and control server, or trying to not log in but get traffic going through it. And most of these were from they were from different organizations, most of them in the US, and they were typically high technology industrial companies and R&D institutions. So we notified the victims, and we send this via the US CERT so that they could reach out to the victims and tell them that they were most likely compromised by this. So that was the main focus of our investigation into this. But it was kind of fun when this report came out and we sort of discovered that this was tied to the RSA breach. Yeah. And well, if you look at the office hours, as I said, you can see my site. Yeah. That's China and other countries in the same. You can't say it's China based on that, but it's kind of indicator of that too. Yeah. And since then, I guess China has been outed as being behind these attacks anyway, so it's corresponded. Yeah. Of course, you can try to trick this by having a team working pretending to be China, and but that's kind of big operation to pull off, right? You have someone going in at the wrong office hours. Here's another incident that we were also working on at the same time, the operation Shade Rat. So APT1 was sort of the first report, or not the first report, this was before the APT1 report came out, but then many of this campaign were sort of tied together again at a later stage. So I think I'll have to go skip through this because we're running out of time. So I want to go through this last case study, also from when I worked at NorthShirt. There was a Norwegian industrial company that was a victim of spear phishing. So I want to show you how this actually looks like from the inside of an investigation. We analyzed the malware that was attached to the campaign, and we also analyzed network traffic to the command and control server, and we saw that it used this encoded HTML comments in the command channel. So like the comment, like the same type of TTP as used by the comment group. And we also saw that there was a downloading of a stage 2 malware hidden in what appeared to be an image file. So they tried to hide these things. So here's a screenshot from analyzing network traffic, and you see the communication to the command and control server. Anyone see it here? You see the command. Anyone you can recognize the command and control server? It's kaiauto.net. That's actually a compromised server being used in this campaign. And you can see that there is something that is inside of HTML comments here, which is not processed by the server. And something that looks a little bit strange, right? This one. It's kind of suspicious. So that's, of course, what strikes the analyst's interest in this case, to figure out what is in this comment. So actually, it is a command sent to the malware running on the target computer. It's not... So what it's claiming to do is to download a JPEG image. So if you look at the traffic analysis, like in Wireshark, you see that content type image JPEG, it's not a JPEG image, it's just looking like it. It's a web page with this HTML comment tags, and this is base64 encoded using a special non-standard alphabet. So it's not really encrypted, it's kind of not real encryption, I would say. It's so base64 is used for transmitting binary data, and usually it just has this corresponding letters to numbers, but you can do this in a little bit kind of specific crafted way. So one of our analysts just made a tool that goes through all the different ways you can encode with the non-standard alphabets in base64 and runs this. and sees that this is actually redirecting to this HTTP site. And this is again an image